Welcome back. So about 8 years ago, is everybody, about 8 years ago, Tewari Salah, one of our guiding teachers, and two other assistant teachers, Lauren Wilson and Lyndall Johnson, and I started the Sunday Sit. And we started it for a couple reasons. One is we really wanted a place where parents could come and bring their kids. So often in two parent families, they'd say, well, one could come and the other stays home. And so this was when we were down in Soto and we set up a little carpeted area and with some quiet toys and stuff. And the first 5 minutes of the meditation, we often included ideas for the kids. And then the beginning of every Dhamma talk started with a children's story. So I am going to revitalize that idea. I have this fabulous story to share this morning. The second reason we started the Sunday Sit was back when our founding teacher, when we met, he came from a particular tradition where you came in silence, you sat in silence, you took your break in silence, and you left in silence. And the four of us wanted to get to know people. We take three refuges in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And it was hard to really feel part of the Sangha when we were always in silence. That's when volunteering was even more important then, because that was the only way you'd get to know anybody is if you sign up and work together. So I'm going to and as I mentioned, we are starting on Right View this month, and I have this fabulous book that is right about Right View. And it's written by a Dharma friend of mine who I met at Sims many years ago. He lives over on Bainbridge Island, and his name is George Shannon. And for those of you on Zoom, I am going to try my best for you to be able to see this. It's called White is for Blueberry. And if anybody wants to come up close, just like the kids used to do, they'd kind of snuggle right in. I'm going to read you this story. Okay. Let's see if I can. So first I'm going to do it to here and then I'll lower it for the Zoom people. Pink is for crow. When it has just hatched from the egg. Black is for poppy. When we take the time to look inside. Red is for leaves. Thank you, Cheryl, for making a change. Oh, you didn't do it. Somebody did. Okay. Oh, good. Red is for leaves when they are blowing in an autumn breeze. Green is for turnip when we see it in the farmer's field. Purple is for snow when the snow is the shadow of us. White is for blueberry when the berry is still too young to pick. Blue is for firelight when the fire is at the tip of the candle wick. I'm not doing such a great job with this. So Carol Guile, who is online, is the world's best storybook teller. And I'm sorry, Carol, that I'm not doing as good a job as you. Brown is for sweet potato when the potato is still inside its skin. Orange is for the sky when the sun has nearly set. It all depends on when we look, how near or far, outside or in. White is for Blueberry by George Shannon. So after sharing the book, I asked the young ones some questions, but I think these might be good questions for all of us. Has it ever happened to you that you thought one thing was true, only to find out later that it wasn't? Maybe you had that experience in the woods or on the beach in nature. And I think all of us have probably had the experience when we meet someone new and we bring all these assumptions and then we find out later that we were totally wrong. So as George Shannon, the book's author, says, it all depends on when we look, how near or far, outside or in. And I'll add a few other things that it depends on. It depends on how we look. Do we have all kinds of preconceived notions, or are we looking with an open mind? And it also depends on what kind of attitude we bring to it. What kind of mind state? Are we convinced that we're just right all along, even though the facts in front of us are telling us something different? And it depends on who is looking and whether we're all just wrapped up in me and mind and everything is about me. So tonight, we're starting our exploration of right view, the first of the Eightfold Path. Right view is what gets us started on the path. For those of you who were either here last week or somehow listened to Carrie's talk, she described how the path, the Eightfold Path, is divided into three categories of training, or you could call them three classifications of practice. The first is panya, which is a Pali word for wisdom, and that includes right view and right intention. Right view this month, right intention next month. Sila, which is the Pali word for morality or ethics, then those are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And the third category of practice is samadhi, those practices that help us gather and settle the mind, and includes right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right view gets us started and leads the way. And when it's perfected, when you really have found yourself in a clear, settled way with right view, all the others follow. The Eightfold Path, as Carrie was describing, is not a linear one. It's not that you have to start at one place and move along. It's more of a spiral. And we need to practice and strengthen all of the aspects, which in turn each one then strengthens and nurtures the other. Right view, along with right intention, set the direction. It helps us understand where we start and where we're going. And to go on any path, it's really helpful if you know where you're going. I love this little conversation between Alice and the cat in Alice in Wonderland. The cat says, "Where are you going?" Alice says, "Which way should I go?" The cat says, "That depends on where you're going." And Alice says, "I don't know." The cat says, "Then it doesn't matter which way you go." Well, with our paths, we actually know where we want to go. The Buddha told us that we were going towards the end of suffering, and following the Eightfold Path is how we get there. We have to understand dukkha. We know what it is. We know how it feels in our bodies, in our minds, and in our hearts. We understand the cause of dukkha, the clinging, the tight-fisted attachment. And we know that we can be freed from this dukkha. Following the Dhamma, following this Eightfold Path, we can be freed from suffering. Right view provides the kind of perspective for practice. There's this wonderful American Buddhist scholar, his name is Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he describes right view this way. Wisdom, which is both right view and right intention, they unfold gradually and are dependent on a concentrated mind. Sometimes a word instead of concentrated is kind of gathered, settled. So on a concentrated mind, which happens through regular meditation, clear of distraction. Wisdom and concentration then combine to guide us in the morality elements, and then they help us loop back into a broader, deeper understanding of right view. The Buddha said that just as the dawn is the forerunner and the first indication of the rising sun, so is right view the forerunner and the first indication of wholesome states. So right view gets us going. Usually it's often the introduction to the path. Philip Moffitt, who comes here at least by Zoom every December and is a wonderful teacher, is one of Tewari's teachers and has been one of my teachers as well. He says it comes at the beginning of the Eightfold Path because without realizing there's dukkha in your life and that you can do something about it, you would never be motivated to start. So for me, I came to the Dhamma after many years as a political activist. I started as a teenager back in the early civil rights campaigns through opposition to the Vietnam War, protesting the U.S. support of oppressive regimes in Central America, wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, you name it. And I had very clear views on what was right and what was wrong. And I held tightly to these views. But at the same time, I'd been a spiritual seeker from the time when I was a little kid. My grandpa lived with us, and he used to refer to me as his little Rebbetzin because of all the grandkids, I was the only one interested in all of the Hebrew stuff and all the holidays and all of that. So I came to the Dharma partly because I didn't really love being filled with so much anger and this kind of unsettledness and a sense of kind of separation from the fullness of life. I and still love a protest rally is like, I'm there and I'm happy. But I found over the years that the way people treated each other, even though all of us on the same side wasn't always so lovely. So back in the early 80s, at the same time that, if you remember back, if some of you weren't born then, but if you remember back to then, you know, there was a lot to protest. But also at that time, my older sister, who was also my best friend, was dying. And she died in May of 83. And my activism really wasn't helping me navigate this grief or understanding kind of what do you do with that kind of loss. So I went to my first retreat, which was a retreat on death and dying, and it was down at Brighton Bush Hot Springs, offered by this wonderful teacher who has since died. His name is Stephen Levine. His books, especially his book, Who Dies? It's about death, but it really isn't. It's about life, and it's fabulous. And I have two copies, and I'd be happy to lend you one if you want to come up and talk to me later. So I went there, and Buddhism invited me to discover a balance between my involvement and engagement in the world and finding some way of settling down and understanding life and me and how do we navigate this. So for many years after that retreat, I would go in for my annual or semi-annual interview with our founding teacher. And regardless of the issue I came in with, he would remind me how tightly I was holding on to my views. So right view is still a big chunk of my practice. I have not fully realized right view, but I have gained a lot of humility, and I've come to understand this teaching of don't know mind. I don't know if people here heard of that teaching, don't know mind. Well, you would think that it's a denial of what one knows, but it really isn't. Don't know mind is an invitation to open up to discovery of what's the truth and what isn't the truth. Tiweri, in a recent email that she sent out, said, "The path is not a rehashing of what we already know. It's a path into the unknown. We practice in the present moment, which has never happened before." So don't know mind is really this invitation that we come into the present moment. Yeah, we bring everything along with us, but we have that kind of open attitude and curiosity. I wonder what's going to happen next. Don't know mind also invites a kind of softness, a loosening of that really tight grip on those views and opinions and habits that have guided us for so long. The practice, the entire practice, invites us to be with things as they truly are. And many of my views, and I don't know if this would fit for you, were more about the way I wanted things to be rather than dealing with what was actually happening. And while I mentioned that practicing with right view is still a big chunk of my practice, I can honestly say that over these years I felt a softening. I've loosened that tight grip, and I've invited myself to explore those views. So a few comments about language. A lot of people dislike right view because it makes you think about wrong view, and then you get into your usual judging mind. The Sunday team, we meet monthly and we talk about the topics, and then we schedule who's going to teach when. And we've had a lot of conversations about right or wise or attuned or aligned or harmonious. There's all these different words that people use. I like right view. And I like it because I think about it, as one of my colleagues mentioned, it's like when you're hanging a picture on a wall and you right it so that it's in balance. It's not hanging this way or that way. It's not too high, not too low. It's just right. It's in balance. But I invite you, as you're starting your practice with all of the rights, the Eightfold Path, find the word that's going to be right for you, going to be feel aligned and connected and harmonious for you. And if you choose right view and you find that a lot of judgment comes up, another opportunity to practice with what is the judging mind like? What's that like in your body? What happens when that's where you're going? All of this practice is about deepening our understanding of our minds and our hearts. So finding your right language is part of that. You know, views, they start as a thought, and then it's repeated and repeated, and we act from the thought, and it becomes part of a storyline, and it morphs into opinions and beliefs and views, and then those are habituated. And They help us function in life, those views and thoughts and opinions. But what right view is inviting us to do is to really examine those views and opinions, those storylines, and see whether they're aligned with the teachings, aligned with your own sense of your moral compass, and aligned in terms of whether they guide you into wholesome actions and you feel good about those. One other bit about language. Pali, which is the language that the Buddha's teachings were written down in, is a language of verbs. Why right view sounds like a noun. And so I'd like to invite us to consider this practice more like their verbs, that their understandings that lead into the right action, that all of these views, intentions, our understanding of right speech, right livelihood, right action, it really matters how we manifest those understandings. So I started us all this evening with the five recollections, because it's such a practice around karma or kama. Ajahn Suchito, who is a senior teacher in the Thai forest tradition, and if you were around last year when we were studying the Paramis, we quoted him all the time, because his book on crossing the flood on the Paramis is fabulous. But he says about right view, it's a recognition that what we do counts. We're not in some kind of predetermined life. We can be effective. We can be a source of benefit or harm for ourselves and others. And such a responsibility, it's not so much a moral obligation as it's a mandate. It says if we develop clarity and kindness and the clarity of mind and heart, we can live with that kind of mind. Right view is the recognition that our own integrity has to be at the center of our lives. But how do we know what's right view and what's not right view? So have any of you heard of this sutta called the Kalamas? They were a group of people who had asked the Buddha to come and talk to them because they said, hey, this guy comes along and he says, this is the way we should practice. And then this other one comes along and says, this is the way we should practice. Then you come along. And almost all of them were guys back then. And you come along and you say something different. And so the Kalama Sutta is where a lot of people start talking about that Buddhism is not dogmatic. It really says, find your own way. You know, the Pali phrase, ehi pasiko, which means, what does it mean? See for yourself. Thank you. Somebody just said that. It was in there, and then it just went. So the Kalama Sutta does say, the Buddha says to them, use your own sense of right and wrong and common sense. But we've all sat with a lot of teachers, and one of the main things they teach us is don't believe every thought that comes into your head. So it's a little bit of a paradox. We're told we should trust our own sense of right and wrong, but we shouldn't trust all those thoughts that come in, which are the ones who are telling us what's right and wrong. So here's some helpful suggestions from Tanisaro Biko. He wrote some comments on the Kamala Sutta, or the Kalama Sutta. And he points out that our preferences are not to be followed simply because they seem logical or resonate with our feelings. Any view or belief must be tested by the results it yields when put into practice and then checked against the experience of people who are wise. It is my belief that those people who are wise are right here. We are in this Sangha, and we've all been practicing, And there is some wisdom that's percolating in there. So from that sutta and other teachings, we're given that phrase, ehipasiko, see for yourself. It's a guiding principle for our practice in the path. See for yourself. You have your own practice. We examine our own selves, our own minds and hearts, our own views and actions. And we use discrimination and we see how our views and actions affect others. Wise view is really a recognition of the truth of karma. All actions have consequences, even if we aren't aware of those consequences. What we do matters. The Buddha instructs us to look at, in one of the places, he calls them all dhammas. It's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the dhammas include teachings, mental qualities, and actions. And here's what he says about how we should figure out what's skillful and what's not skillful. When you know for yourself that these dhammas, again, they're teachings, mental qualities, and actions. When these dhammas are unskillful, these dhammas are blameworthy, these dhammas are criticized by the wise, these dhammas, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. And similarly, when you know for yourself that these dhammas are skillful, they're blameless, these dhammas are praised by the wise, when adopted and carried out, they lead to welfare and happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. So it's really an invitation to do some investigation. This practice of the entire path is our own individual practice. But really, the Eightfold Path, you got to go in before you can come out and see what you know. It's our own personal practice. It's a going inside. So how do we practice with right view? The very first thing we do is we look at, what are those views that I carry around with me that have guided my behavior? The ones that keep coming back over and over again, kind of almost in a sneaky way. Like, I was just recently on retreat at Cloud Mountain, and what a surprise, a very old set of views which have been really problematic for me, there they were. And it was an invitation to do some investigation, some renunciation, some practice with these old views. So that's the very first thing. We examine the view and we examine the emotional content that goes along with it. How often we have said to ourselves and sometimes to others, well, I just feel this way, as if that's the truth of things. Well, we examine what's behind this, I just feel this way about this view, these opinions that I have. So it starts with a real honest examination. And I love how last year we practiced with the paramis, the parami of truthfulness, of resolve, of kindness, of generosity. Bring it along. They're going to really be helpful. So you first look at them and acknowledge. Then you look back, where did they come from? Often they've come from childhood decisions, and back then they were useful. The set of views that came up to me on retreat, I could see why I did that. It had all to do with the family of origin that I came from and where I was in the family and who else was around and what was going on. So I made these little kid decisions. Well, these little kid decisions were helpful when I was a little kid. Not so helpful now that I'm all grown up. So we ask ourselves, where did they come from? And are they still useful? Were they ever useful? You know, there's a teaching when the Buddha taught about renunciation, and he said, my heart did not leap up at the idea of renunciation. But what he did is he looked at the benefit and the drawback. So that's what we're going to be looking at too with your views. What are the benefits of these views that guide your behavior, that guide your life? And what are some of the drawbacks? Examine how these views lead to certain actions. Are the actions wholesome? Have they ever caused harm to you or others? Do they actually lead to the reduction of suffering? Or do they maybe create more suffering for you and others? In what way do we feed these views that move us along? How many times we've told the same storyline that reinforces that view? And how it plays a role in our lives. So look at how you're feeding, nurturing these views. Asking yourself, do these views really align with how I want to be in this world, what my moral compass says I like to be? For many of us, one of our highest values is do no harm. Support others, show that we're connected. So do your views align with that? Do they align with the other teachings? Or are they in conflict? Are they denying the truth of dukkha, anicca, and anatta? Or the truth of the first three noble truths? Ask yourself how identified you are with these views. You've thought this way, you've behaved this way your whole time. Is that really who you still are? Is that the identity that you want to keep cultivating? And one of the important things, when I said earlier that we are the wise ones, there's a Pali term called Kalyana Mita. It means spiritual friend. And I have found that one of the best ways for me to deal with some of those sticky areas of practice, and sticky areas for me are some of these views that are no longer very useful, is to talk with my Kalyana Mitas about it. Yeah, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I have friends who are not practitioners, lovely people. I'll bring up an issue like, wow, I've got this view that I've been dealing with forever. It's not really, you know, being very helpful. And they go, oh, I'm so sorry that that's happening for you. And then I talk to a Dharma friend and they go, wow, well, let's see. Well, what's that about? You know, where are you holding on to things? Is this the truth of clinging? And, you know, and they're in there with you. They're in there with you in your practice because that's what they're doing too. That's what we're all doing. So cultivate those Kalyana Mita. And recognize that our culture supports so many wrong views that often practicing with right view is hard. The culture supports views of separateness, of othering, hyper-consumerism, non-stop distractions, addictions, and supports for all kinds of acts of greed, hatred, and ill will. To say nothing about delusion. Oops. And once you've done all these practices, looking at them, acknowledging them, dissecting it, looking at where the benefits are, where the drawbacks, how it manifests in your actions, talking to Dharma friends about it, really exploring, you're going to notice some changes. You're going to start noticing that this tight grip on whatever that view is just loosening up a little. So yesterday at the Sunday sit, one of our newer colleagues, Nanak Yesi, gave a fabulous talk on right view. And I wrote him today and I said, I'm stealing some of your ideas. I don't think it's up on the website yet, but if you have a part of your practice is listening to talks, it's really a good one. He's a lovely guy. And he gave us a list of how do you know when you've actually realized right view, when those changes start happening. And I'm going to share his list, and I changed them a little bit, and I added a little bit. So the first is there's less emotional reactivity. The way I would say it is that more often you are seeking an appropriate response to life's experiences and not just reacting out of habit. There are more pauses. There's more quiet. There's more time when you write the email and then you close it and then you come back later and maybe you send it. There's more reflection. And that question of what is the appropriate response is really alive in you. So less emotional reactivity. A second, he says, is there's decreased clinging to experiences, roles, and outcomes. Another way of saying it, I think, is that you're open to the fact that life unfolds. Life flows. We don't control stuff. We do have influence, of course, but life really has its own way of showing up. For those of you who've heard me before, when my partner of 35 years died suddenly some years ago, my world turned upside down, and I came up with this mantra with the help of a Dharma teacher. And my mantra is, may I trust in the natural unfolding of life, and may I receive that unfolding with wisdom and understanding. It's a very different way than this is the way it should be, and if I do these six things, this is what's going to happen. And of course I do that. I run a business. I mean, we all have our lives. We all make plans, and we do things, and we have our to-do lists. But it's a different kind of orientation. The third thing he says is that compassion and forgiveness arise spontaneously. Another way of saying it that really resonates for me is that all the Brahma Viharas, kindness, metta, loving kindness, compassion, mudita, and happiness and equanimity, that they're readily available to us. They're not something we have to go, oh, right, what are those things? How do I go find them? We find that those qualities of heart are way more accessible. We also have more increased confidence in our own experience and our own practice. We've worked with that paradox of ehi pasiko, see for yourself, and we're starting to really understand it. And you find that more and more of your actions lead to goodwill and less harm. You behave more consistently in ways that you know your actions have consequences. You know that karma is real. And you're less identified with all those views that are all about me and mine. You find those times, you know, anatta or not self is a difficult part of the Dharma. But it helped me when I took it from not self into the way Christina Feldman describes it as selfing. And if you think about when the selfing is thick and present and everywhere and loud, and then when the selfing is thinner and quieter and maybe just kind of hanging out in the corner, and you start noticing that difference in how much of me and mine is present. Buddhism, for me, offers a way to live in the world without being overcome by the world. And it's a process of greater and greater sensitivity. The first three noble truths ask us to be sensitive to the reality of life. Suffering is there. We know it and we honor it. Then we are asked to be even more sensitive because we're asked to look at, well, how's all this dukkha caused? All that tightness, all that clinging, all that creating views and storylines. We keep practicing with the way things are, and that continues to sensitize us. We say the five recollections: aging, illness, death, and loss and separation. And we underscore all of this with an attitude of kindness. So here we are, these very sensitive beings, continuing this process of deepening our sensitivity. We deepen our understanding of views and opinions and the actions that lead to the end of suffering. I wish you well in this month. It's a good one. It's rich. And I welcome your practice. Thank you for your attention. So we got time. We've got time both from the Zoom folks and the in-person folks. How's it going with these Four Noble Truths? What about wise, right view or wise view, or what's up for anyone? It's a pretty open discussion time. Cheryl will bring around a microphone, and anybody online can go to the bottom of your screen, and it's either, some of them say raise hand, and some you have to go into the react button, and then you'll see a raise hand. Or you can go like this, and let's see if I see you. So I'd really love to hear, what's this like for you? And a reminder, every single question in all the years that I've been sitting in Sangha has been fabulous. Really. Sometimes it's exactly the question I should have asked. And sometimes I go, oh, wow, yeah. And sometimes the answer or the next response is just what you needed to hear. So I know it's not easy to speak up in a big group. And there's like 40 of us here and another 60 online. And but to a person, I'm amazed at the kindness and generosity of people in the Sangha. It certainly has been the case for those of us in Sunday when none of us had ever taught the Dharma before in our lives. And then people just sat there and, well, yeah, bring it on, you know? So know that this is a safe group. So with that, yes, please, Cheryl, thanks. And say your name first, if you would.
Hello, I'm Haley.
Hi, Haley.
Hi, thank you. That was an amazing talk. I'll try to formulate this question succinctly. As you were speaking, I always listen to talks and apply them to like my immediate life, and a lot of these things feel interpersonal to me. I was thinking about right view as it relates to our relationships with other people. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the idea that I know I and a lot of people I love come from a history of sometimes being over-flexible in our thinking and wanting so badly to bring compassion and mindfulness for others' well-being, and sometimes we lose track of our own limitations or our own like boundaries in the process. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about also what you were saying about the importance of not harming people. And I guess I'm curious about that delicate balance between embodying right view and bringing compassion and decreased reactivity to interactions, while also, especially for those of us who don't have a history of taking care of ourselves or setting limits, or being truthful about our limits, what is that dance and any thoughts you might have on it?
Wow, that's such a good question. Thanks, Haley. Our founding teacher used to say, if you never go on retreat and all you do is practice in relationship, that is a fabulous practice. Because everything is there, right? Everything. All the preferences and annoyances and patterns and their habits and your habits and the culture and the family and the dynamics, it's all there. So my first response is just to honor that it's challenging, regardless of which family you are coming from or which relationship. For me, I come from a set of views where other people's needs were always more important than mine, because my mother was widowed at a very young age and was depressed and sad, and my older sister was born disabled. So, and there I was, able-bodied, and my life was fine, and so I'm not going to say, well, hey, I want whatever. So I've looked at that and realized that I was not being fair, not only to myself, but to others either, because others want to know, not strangers, but people in your life who are your friends, they want to know what you want. They want to know who you are. So being really honest with yourself about what's your pattern? How do you want to show up? That's really important. Another piece that I've used, I have a very dear friend who would do anything for me and is so annoying and is so difficult to be with. And I, you know, we've talked about it and talked about it. And finally, what I came up with was, I'm going to call her Jane. I came up with this little mantra, let Jane be Jane. Just let her be who she is. And then I had to add, let Suze be Suze. Because there was the truth of it. Her with her stuff, me with my stuff. That was the truth of the moment and the moments of our interaction. So it's like acknowledging what is actually happening and let it be. And then use your good discernment to say, hey, could we have a talk about when you say these things or do these things or I do this and why do I piss you off? And, you know, I mean, you do that. But there's a kind of honoring of just the basic humanity of each other. Those are my first two thoughts. And good luck, because, I mean, really. Well, no, I do have a third thought. So I've been widowed for almost 8 years. I met a guy, and there are so many things wrong, right? I mean, mainly because he's not the one who died. But I had my lists of things, and he's a nice man. We've had our conversations, and one day we were going to have another one of those hard conversations, and instead of bringing my list, I said to him, I'd like it if we were closer. And he said, me too. Well, of course, the devil's in the details, right? But it did something. It just said, what my heart really wanted was to just be closer together. So that's the third thing, is there's all of the lists and the things that are right and wrong and who are you and I had trauma and this is the fate, you know, and I was the oldest or the middle or the young, you know, whatever. But then there's what's the essence of the heart's desire? And I was so grateful. It felt like, Philip Moffat says this, the Dharma does you sometimes. And I felt like the Dharma did me and said, I just would like to be closer. Instead of bringing my list of how he should be or how I should be. That was a long answer. Sorry, I kind of went on. But relationships, right? And views about relationships. Whew. Anybody online, anything that's up that would feel good to say while they're thinking about it? Please, Carol. Cheryl, we got Carol right here in the black sweater. There we go.
So it's Carolyn.
Oh, Carolyn, sorry.
Okay. No problem. Well, I'm really glad you said the last part of all that, because I'm getting ready to go to the couples counseling, and I think starting with, I just want to be closer. Yeah, sounds like a really good place to start. And I'm ready with the list, too, or I will be ready with the list.
Aren't we all?
But yeah. Maybe I'll put that in my pocket. Yeah.
I wish you well with that. It's brave and wonderful. You know, not only are we sensitive beings, but we're all so tender and vulnerable. We just all are. I don't know if this ever happens to you, but sometimes I walk around on the streets and I look at people and they look so unhappy or so angry or so whatever. And I just go, oh, honey, you know, because that's really, here we are, just these vulnerable, tender beings trying to navigate what is often a difficult life. Even when it's easy, it's difficult. I mean, partly because we make it more difficult, but it's challenging, and the culture is challenging, and the times are challenging. And of course, if you're a student of history, the times have always been challenging. We're not living in the plague. We're not living under Hitler. We're not living during the Depression. We're not, you know, I mean, or the flu that killed everybody in, thank you, the Spanish flu in 1918. But we're living in these times, and they're crazy enough. And then, you know, what do you do? Yeah. Oh, Deb Slavinsky, would you like to say something?
I would, Suze. How are you tonight? Thank you so much for your talk.
Nice to see you.
Oh.
She moved to Whidbey Island.
Yeah, see. That's my reputation now in the Sangha. She moved away from Seattle. Yeah.
No, your reputation is when we used to have day longs, you and I would go get day old donuts and bring them back to everybody. That's your reputation. Okay, what's your question?
Yeah, Susan and I were the donut queens. Donut queens. My comment and question, I guess, is all through your talk, Suze, which I really enjoyed, I was thinking about the political culture that we find ourselves in, the cancel culture, I think it's appropriately called. You see the other person or emblems of the other side, and immediately it's like a big X, right? Whatever they stand for or whoever they are, have nothing to do with them. I cancel them out. Where I live here on the island, there is a stretch of road where there's a dwelling, somebody's house, and they have a wooden fence in front of it, and it's on a busy road, and they have signs up for the opposite political party all over the place. Big signs, you cannot miss this. And I feel my reaction to this display of political choice as I go by, and it's usually fairly negative. In fact, it's quite negative. Now, if I were to meet this individual in the local grocery store, because this is a small island, you mix it up with people, and it's important on a small island to kind of behave yourself, because you will run into one another in the grocery store or the hardware store. If I were to, I don't even know who this person is with the signs, but if he were in the local grocery store and he was wearing maybe a button or something, you know, how would I react to this person? I don't even know this person. you know, maybe they need help getting the salt down from the upper shelf and they can't reach it. Am I going to say to myself, oh, listen, I'm not getting the salt for you, buddy. You know, you tough it out because you've got that button on or you're wearing that hat and I'm not going to have anything to do with helping you.
And is that really what would happen in your mind?
I don't think so, but I think that it can be taken to lengths, like, you know, when I start to cancel out other people,
mm-hmm.
really, would we go to that length? I mean, if I'm already saying to myself, I don't want anything to do with you, or what you believe or who you are, does that mean that in a moment of inconvenience, that I can't reach something on the high shelf, can you get this down for me, lady? Would I walk away and say, forget it. You're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That would be I would feel terrible about myself in terms of, you know, living the way that I would wish to see myself live. And talking mm-hmm. about my karma, mm-hmm. that's my karma.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you voted for the other guy, but it's my karma if I refuse to extend a hand of help to you.
Ooh.
So I think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think you're not alone in thinking about that. Probably, I'm a bit of a Dharma junkie, so I do Sunday morning, Monday night, Tuesday morning, Thursday morning. I have a group on Wednesday. I go to Clear Mountain on Saturday. And 80 to 90% of the time, somebody raises this question that, or concern, or tension, or challenge. How do we navigate life when we are so divided and don't have the opportunity to just sit down over a cup of coffee and find out, well, you know, who are you? What's your family like? What do you do during the day? What do you believe? What, you know, why do you believe what you believe? How can I understand you? How can you understand me? It's so challenging. So the concern you raise is such a real one. And I wish I had some great wisdom to put out there. Just like I came to be who I am and you came to be who you are through all of your conditions, all of your experiences, what your family was like, where you went to school, maybe your early experience in church or synagogue or mosque or wherever, and all of that. Other people did too. And they came to their own view, probably in similar processes. I mean, how does it happen? I think the process for coming to our place of how do we understand the world, the process is pretty similar. And I think there's a balance of discernment with acting on the values that you hold dear and balancing it with a general attitude of kindness and care and generosity towards others. There was a teaching that I learned a few months ago when we were talking about metta. And in this teaching, it said that the basis of metta is that just as I value my life, I don't want you hurting me. And you value your life. And I don't want you stealing, taking anything from me that's mine. You value your things. I want to be respected. You want to be respected. That is where the whole practice of kindness kind of came from, is that understanding of the basic nature of humans, is that we want to be safe and protected and cared for and live our lives. So, Deb, I wish I had wisdom. I think that the dealing with that tension, it's like another one of those paradoxes, the paradox of don't trust your mind, but that's where you're going to find whether it's a right view or a wrong view. You know, you come from a place of heart and caring, and at the same time, you act and are engaged in ways that you think are aligned with your own sense of sila, of morality, of your view of the world. And then we walk that tension. I wish it was something better to say. Because I'm just living in the tension.
Yeah, no, we what is it that Ajahn Suchito said? We cross the floods by not pushing forward and not standing still.
Yeah. I would like to tell a story. So 5-6 years ago, the Seattle Times did a front page article on Sunday morning about my property. It's an unusual commercial village, and this business reporter learned about it, and it's a lovely, lovely article. And it interviewed some of my tenants, and they interviewed me, and I talked about some of how much the property taxes are based on the wrong idea that highest and best use, which basically means whoever can make the most money out of things. Anyway, so there was this article, came out on a Sunday. Thursday morning, I get this letter in the mail, and it's written in a handwriting that sometimes is, you think of somebody who's kind of elderly. It was kind of, I open up this letter. There's $1,000 check made out to me from this guy in Eastern Washington. So, you know, I thanked him. I did whatever. I paid it forward, yada, yada. 6 months go by. I'm going to be in Eastern Washington. I reach out to him. Can my friends and I take you out to lunch? So we all meet. He's a apple orchardist. So we're all meeting. He hated lunch. It was one of these hippie lunches. And anyway, but he ate. And I said to him, why did you send me this money? And he said, I thought you hated the government. Well, and so politically, we're like miles apart. This guy loves his family. He adores growing apples, and he knows everything there is about apple growing in Eastern Washington. He's involved in his community. He's a bit of a race car fanatic, and was just an all-around decent human being. And for several years after that, I would get a case of apples from him shipped over. And I was so grateful for that opportunity, which we don't have very often, of sitting down with somebody who thinks I hate the government and seeing who he is. And he was seeing who I was. And I invited him over. I said, if you're ever over on the West Side, come visit. And then I whispered in his ear, you might even meet a couple socialists when you're here. And we just like each other, you know? And I wish there were more opportunities for the guy with the signs on his house and you to sit down over coffee or, you know, whatever, and go, who are you and what's important to you? Yeah.
Excuse me.
Thanks, Sue. Deb.
You got one more online.
Okay, good.
Sorry.
Deanna and Bo, hi. You need to unmute. Yep. There you
Sorry
go.
About that.
Hi, are you Deanna?
I'm Deanna, yes.
Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk and just being so open. And I was curious if you would be up for talking about how right view is connected to grief. You talked about, you know, you shared some examples in a very open-hearted way. And I'm thinking about how you said, like, writing is the verb and like you have these views and then you have to kind of write them. And I was just wondering if there was anything like that for you in the grieving process that you found?
Wow, thanks for that question. Well, for those of you who, there are probably many here who have lost people, who've had people you love who have died, grief runs the show. You can think that you're going to do ABC, but it just goes. One of the reasons why the five recollections are so important to me is that it reminds me that the question, why did Bill die? Well, because that's the nature of life. People die. You know, he had a rip in his aorta. He was dead in a minute. Why do people get sick? Because we're all subject to where it's part of being who we are. So one of the things about right view is remembering natural law, the natural law of being born into this realm, and that we are all subject to aging, illness, and death. And what we do with that truth, and we're subject to loss from all that we hold dear, what we do with that is our practice. It's the right view, it's the right action, it's right mindfulness. What do we do with that? Do we get angry? Do we be more grateful? Do we try to live life more fully? Do we become monks and nuns? I mean, it's for everyone to go, well, what do we do with these natural laws of life? And when sometimes life just hits you upside of your head and just goes, well, you thought it was going here, but it's going here. And that's the truth of it. And so what do you do when you honor the experience and you reach out to your Kalyanamitas and you let people love you, which is often hard for a lot of us who are independent and, you know, but you let people love you in the way that, you know, you let them feed you. You let people in as much as you can. And going back to Haley's point, you also remember your own boundaries. I mean, it's like another relationship. And if you are in the midst of grief, may you find your way. And, you know, folks, life is hard. And it's not always hard. It's also incredible. I mean, all you have to do is walk around right now and there is so much life screaming to live more and to be bigger and, you know, just here I am, you know, with all the trees and the flowers and if you're a gardener and all that, I mean, it's amazing and friendships and connections and there's so much beauty and so much and aging, illness, death, and loss. It's right there, right next to the little kitty video, you know. They're all there, right, all at the same time. How do we navigate? I think that's what the Dharma says. It honors how difficult it is and then gives us some ideas as to how to go. You recognize that it's hard. And you recognize that some of it's hard just because it happens, but a lot of the hard is because of our clinging and that second arrow that, or the third arrow or the fourth arrow that we bring onto it. And that there are moments of freedom. There are. And it could be a flash. You go, oh, right, that view no longer serves me. It's not really what's happening in this moment. Can I just like take a breath, open up my mind and find out what's really happening in this moment? That's a moment of freedom. That's a moment of, yeah. And with grief, It's not 24/7, at least that wasn't my experience. It was a lot, it was ever present, but not always there. I had an experience a few months after Bill died. I live near the canal. I live on Lake Union. I was walking on the canal. It was one of these gorgeous Seattle days. The blue sky is reflecting on the canal, the water, and it's gorgeous, and there are birds flying around, and I'm sitting there. And the thought came to me, what's missing in this moment? And the answer was nothing. Bill had died, but he wasn't going to be on this walk with me anyway. You know, he was going to go do something else. So what was missing? Nothing. And that's, life is so much the both and. The hard and the beautiful and the challenging and the clarity and the greed and the non-greed and the hatred and the non-hatred and the delusion and the non-delusion. And our job is to know what's up, what's here. You know, what is here in this moment? I don't know if I went off on a thing, Deanna.
You said a lot of helpful things. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, really.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wow. Right view. Lots of juicy stuff to work with. I want to do some announcements and dedication of merit.